two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, we are joined by Ian Hogue. He's a colleague of mine now, and he's a man of many talents who, through perseverance and drive, has accomplished some very inspiring goals that I believe could show people what their potential is and what they can aspire to in their own lives if they just kind of put their minds to it.
In other words, you're going to make us all feel bad about the goals, the resolutions already set.
All of us are going to feel so inadequate after this is over, we won't even know what to do with ourselves. Okay. I can tell you right now. And he's way younger than me, which even makes it worse, but that's another story. Okay. So, Ian, thank you for being with me and putting up with my nonsense. But I talked to you about it already. I just find, like, just your story is fascinating to me, but more importantly, I do believe it really can help inspire people because we all go through challenges in our lives, and sometimes we don't know what we want, or sometimes we try to strive for goals, but we don't quite reach them. And you've been able to do a lot of what you wanted to do in your life, and still there's more that you feel like you can do and that you try to do as you know, you continue to live. So tell me a little, kind of let's start in the beginning. You grew up in New England?
Yeah, in Boston. And yeah, so I was born in Boston. My parents lived on a tugboat, which is a whole nother story, right? That you haven't heard yet. But when I was five, we moved to Israel for a year and a half. My dad was an engineer working on lasers. Like that was his thing. He loved optics, and he was an electrical engineer. Then we moved back. Went through high school in Boston, mm-hmm. Went to the Naval Academy.
Stop right there, though. Okay. Like, so go to the Naval Academy. Don't you have to have, like, a congressional nomination to that? So,
yes.
Like, was that something you aspired to? How did that come about?
So, let's see. When I was, I want to say, about 9 years old, my brother joined an organization called the United States Naval Sea Cadet Corps. Which is a great youth organization run by the Navy. It's similar to Boy Scouts, you know, what have you. Mm-hmm. And so then when I was old enough, when I was 10 or 11, I also joined and did that through through high school. Mm-hmm. And some of that, I think, also comes from my mother's brother, so my uncle and my grandfather on my mother's father, both of them were in the Navy, and so there's some naval tradition in our family, and so I think we're kind of carrying on that tradition in some sense, and maybe the I also grew up sailing. My parents had a sailboat, mm-hmm. growing up, and
how do you end up on a tugboat though? How did that end up happening? Do you just live on it, or is this operational?
It was a tax evasion scheme. Because I guess in Massachusetts, you had to pay taxes on land, and you had to pay taxes on any motorized vehicle. This tugboat didn't have an engine, so it was neither land nor was it a motorized vehicle. So they didn't have to pay any taxes.
Okay, well, you know, that's good old American ingenuity there.
There you go.
So yeah. Did you have other siblings besides your brother?
I have a half-sister on my dad's side.
All right.
Yeah.
So, okay, so when you were in high school, obviously, in order to get this congressional recommendation or appointment, you have to – you were pretty good academically? Is that kind of all along through school or no?
my brother was a lot better than I was. So I think he kind of like paved the way for me a little bit. Mm-hmm. And having him already at the Naval Academy, I think helped. Because my grades sometimes were mediocre. Mm-hmm.
So your mom and dad raised two Naval Academy, Academy graduates.
Yeah.
Okay, yep. Well, they're proud of their sons now, yes.
Yep.
So you get to the academy. What do you, I mean, did you have a sense of what it is you wanted to do? I mean, did you have a plan or some goals when you reached there?
And what year is this? Like, yeah. Where are we at as a country?
So I graduated high school in 94.
Okay.
Yeah.
So right after the first
Gulf
Persian
War.
Gulf War. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so I kind of remember this maybe formative moment when I read a Clive Cussler novel called Raise the Titanic. And at the end, the Navy SEALs go in and they have all this high-tech gear and they take down the bad guys. And just the way it all played out, I was like, you know what, that was really smart, like the way they went about that. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to do that.
So reading this book gave you the inkling that you wanted to, potentially be a SEAL.
Yes. Yeah.
Did you have any idea what it took to become one?
A little bit. Yeah. So that was certainly intimidating, I guess, especially when I got to like junior year of high school. I ran cross country in high school, cross country and track. Mm-hmm. And so I was really skinny. I was like 135 pounds. But I could do a ton of push-ups and sit-ups, do calisthenics all day long. But I signed up with a gym, and there was a guy who was a Navy SEAL who was training me a little bit. And, he was working on my upper body strength, and it was kind of overwhelming. It was scary.
I would imagine, especially if you're relatively – because you and I – what are you, 5'8", 5'9"?
Yep.
So, I mean, an average-sized person, but you were trying to do a very outsized thing, or at least considering doing something like that because, I mean, SEALs are what, like 0.1% of the people make it through that kind of training?
So out of the people who actually get to start the training, mm-hmm. Like 20%-ish
okay.
make it through. So, half the people who don't make it through they just quit of their own free will. And then the other half that don't make it through, they just get injuries. Their bodies just can't handle it.
Because it is.
And it's not their own shortcoming that they should feel guilty for or anything. You know?
So what did you study when you were in the academy?
I studied naval architecture. So it's a subset of mechanical engineering.
Okay.
There's three deep, dark secrets to naval architecture.
Which are?
How do you make it float? That's number one. Number two is how do you make it float right side up? And number three is how do you make it go from point A to point B?
Okay. All of those, which would seem to be, I guess very important because you don't want to be upside down floating. So are we talking ships or submarines?
Yes.
Well, whatever it is. Yes. The vessel.
Yeah.
What are you thinking when you're in the Naval Academy and sort of you choose to go the SEAL route? Are you thinking this is what you wanted it to? Was it your expectation or what are you thinking?
Well, yeah. So I wanted to do it. And then from the Naval Academy, it gets even more daunting, I guess, because at the Naval Academy, you're face to face with everybody else who wants to get into the SEAL teams. And at the time there were only 16 billets.
What's a billet?
A billet is like an assignment. Like when you graduate from the Naval Academy, you get your assignment. Sometime during your senior year, you get your assignment on what part of the Navy you're going to go into and what you're going to do. So there's 16 billets for the SEAL teams. And there were 42 of us competing for those 16 billets.
Okay.
So you can imagine that the competition gets pretty steep. And when we're all face to face with each other, all on the same campus, we know what.
Yeah, we all know
what
those,
the level of competition is, and what we need to beat to get there. So I was kind of middle of the pack among those 42, and I didn't get a billet right out of the Naval Academy.
Okay. So then you go in, you get your, because there's a commission you get when you graduate, right?
Right.
So what are your ensign?
Yep.
Okay. And
so were you disappointed? Were you thinking, I'm just going to do a few years and then be done? Or what were you thinking?
No, I wasn't disappointed. I kind of knew where I stood. And so I realized that the fastest way to get into the SEAL teams after that was to become a surface warfare officer on a ship and then apply for a lateral transfer. So I did that.
We're going to find out more about this, because if you don't know anything about Navy SEALs,
which most
Army
of us
Rangers,
really don't, right? What do we know? What we see in movies?
Know, but the training, grueling doesn't even begin to describe it. It really does not. And I this is why it's so fascinating, right? Because in order to do what you did, and I guess we're giving that part away because he does get to get there. It takes everything you've got and everything you didn't even know you had just to make it to that level. We'll continue with our discussion, Ian Hogue, and there is just so much more after that. This is fascinating. I can't wait to have this story told. You're listening to Voices of Reason.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at KSLPodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. Amy Donaldson, Jason Lee, speaking today with Ian Hogue, who's got a fascinating story, got a commission to the Naval Academy, actually followed in his brother's footsteps and that of some other relatives, because not everybody gets to do that. You have to get a congressional appointment to do that. So you mentioned that you graduate, you get your commission, right? Even though you aspire to become a SEAL, it doesn't quite happen, you know, right out of the box. So you have to work a little bit and you become an officer on a warship. Is that how that works?
Correct. Yeah.
So can you explain a little bit about what that is and your role?
Right. So surface warfare officer is the technical Navy term for all the officers on the warships. And as an officer, you start out as a division officer on a warship. So there's different divisions on the ship. I was in charge of the damage control division. So I had about 10 to 12 guys who worked for me. I was really learning from them as much as probably more than they were learning from me. But but they were in charge of welding, plumbing, and then also taking care of all the firefighting equipment. Mm-hmm. And we were also responsible for sort of training the rest of the ship in damage control. So yes, firefighting, right, responding to flooding.
If something happens, like you guys get damaged, you got to repair it while this is in real time.
Right.
So when you're doing that, okay, so how long do you have to do that? And actually, let me stop for a second. In order to apply to become a SEAL, and one other thing, what is SEAL? What does that mean exactly? It's an acronym.
Yeah, so it's an acronym for Sea, Air, Land, Commando, right?
Essentially. And it is the Navy's version of its most elite warfighters. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, there is like a top tier within the SEAL teams.
Right. No, right. Yeah. There's even, what, SEAL Team 6, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be called SEAL Team 6.
Yeah. Yeah. What's it called now?
It's called I don't know what it's called now, but I think it's public now that it's called, or it was for a while called Development Group. But it wasn't just SEALs. The Development Group was Navy SEALs and Green Berets and combat control technicians.
Yeah. I love that it's called Development Group. It's like the most innocuous, right? It's
no,
like,
right. Dev Group. Yeah, and I mean, there's all these acronyms you guys have to learn too.
Acronyms are ridiculous,
well,
especially to Jason and I, who both have dyslexia. We'd be, sending the wrong group. So as you're, I guess, advancing or moving in that universe, like what did you see as your future? Like, what were you hoping would be? What opportunity do you hope for as a SEAL?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question, because it's like that was the goal, right? It was to be a SEAL. And I didn't really have goals beyond that as I was aspiring to that goal, which was, I don't know, maybe a weakness, a chink in my armor or whatever. You know, that once I got there, I was there and I maybe let my guard down probably too much.
Well, no, but if you climb Mount Everest, that's, and once you get there, I mean, what else is there? But there's other mountains. That's what that is.
Right? Exactly. Yeah.
So when you, okay, so you're able to, after through all of this, you were able to apply. And even after you apply, what is that process? And then how do you actually get to go to the part that I explain is so grueling, because you have to do all this crazy stuff that just nobody else has.
The training.
Yeah, so as an officer, like I mentioned from the Naval Academy, it's really competitive to get into the SEAL teams as an officer. If you want to join the SEAL teams, they can't get enough enlisted guys to get through the program. So mm-hmm. So they pretty much take as many enlisted guys as can pass the basic entrance test. So, but yeah, to get the lateral transfer, I kind of did a little bit of cold calling to the SEAL team commanding officers, got an interview with one of them who had also done a lateral transfer, mm-hmm. and he, I guess he liked my story, and I ended up getting the lateral transfer. You also have to, so there's this basic entrance test of like push-ups, sit-ups, actually it starts with a 500-yard swim, push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, and a mile-and-a-half run.
And that's just to see if you qualify.
Right. And as an officer, you need, like, the bare minimums kind of mean nothing on that. You need to be up in this competitive range. It's really hard.
How fast did you have to run a mile and a half?
9 minutes in, but this is in pants and boots.
Right. It's not in running gear.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So real quick, I just want to.
That was to be competitive. I think the minimum standard was like 12 minutes or something like that.
So when you actually get accepted, and now you can really go through the training, can you explain to people what that training is like, and just, you know, why it is regarded as so difficult?
Yeah, I don't know if I can describe it other than to say go watch Discovery Channel or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
But, well, no, is it just?
But
it's
6 months, right? So the first 5 weeks, I think, is a lot of just physical exercise. So you're doing a lot of calisthenics first thing in the morning. You know, you get up at like 5 a.m. You do a lot of calisthenics, and then you'll do maybe some. So paddling these things called IBS, inflatable boat small, right? Why is it out of order? But whatever. So you paddle, you do the obstacle course, you do beach runs sometime in really deep, soft sand, which is excruciating sometimes.
But like, what are you thinking this is for? Because, I mean, it's like, do you think you're going to be doing this once you're a SEAL?
So it's physical conditioning is what it is.
Sure.
And it's so the training is called BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training, right? And what most people don't have a grasp of, you know, they see the Discovery Channel stuff and like, oh my gosh, that's like the hardest thing I've ever seen. But that's just the basic training. Mm-hmm. When you get to the teams, or even before you get to the teams, you go through SEAL qualification training, which is even harder than the basic training. I mean, it's a lot of the same stuff, but it's just like the next level.
Right.
And then you get to the teams and you do even harder stuff. Like the guys who do winter warfare, I've heard of them, you know, going out with 200 pounds of gear on their back. I can't even imagine, you know, having been through SEAL training, like, I can't imagine carrying that much gear on my back.
So you got a large person on your back.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and moving for, yes, you know, however far they need to move to do their mission, you know,
because that could happen in real life.
Something. Yeah,
that you could have to carry your comrade someplace.
And yeah, that's what. And I could do that for a little while.
You know? Right. Well, I mean, but you and I want you to be able to do it. I guess.
So I guess, what did you learn about yourself when you're doing this? What are you thinking about?
What did you find out about yourself?
What did I find out about myself?
It's not just that you can do hard things. No. Hear me out.
I guess it's that I was really blessed to have the ability to make it through all that. You know, when you see how many people really want it just as much as I did, and some of them didn't make it, right? Mm-hmm. They got injured. They got stress fractures 3 times in a row. Because when you get injured, if you were pulled because you were injured and you didn't just quit, they'll let you try again. They'll let you sit out a class and then come back in two classes later. Yeah. You know, once you're healed, whatever,
yeah.
And try again. And they give you 3 chances. And people would get hurt all 3 times.
Yeah.
Did you find that you were stronger mentally than you thought you might have been, or do you feel like you just lucky enough you had that all along?
I think I always went into it with the mindset of, you know, I'm not going to give up even if I'm crawling down the beach, you know, when everybody else is running.
Because not everybody has that. You know what I'm saying? Like part of the physical part, I get that. But the mental part to overcome these kinds of obstacles is kind of what I'm trying to get at here.
Right.
And that seems to be something that sets you and other people like you apart.
Yeah.
Did you see that? I don't know
how I got there. It's just like I wanted to do this, and
so you did it.
And I knew that's what it took.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into it with that mindset.
But when you look around you and you see other sailors or soldiers or whatever, that you think they're people that you admire, people that you think are strong enough, tough enough, whatever. Did you see something in common with those guys and you? Did you see something that helped you? Like, I don't know.
And maybe this is like another weakness. So I'm an introvert, and maybe, dare I say, a bit narcissistic. Like, I probably wasn't paying enough attention to what the other people were doing.
Because you're focusing on your own thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know.
Which is something that I coach. I mean, we've all played sports.
Yeah.
Tells you to do, right? You control you. You mm-hmm. do. You have to run your own race, even if there's a team that's at stake. But I mean, and you do you have more thoughts on the whole idea of actually being a SEAL?
I want to come back because I want to get back to the mental part of this. Just because to me, what sets you and people like you apart, I believe, is your ability to summon not just the will, but the mental acuity to be great at something, no matter how difficult it is, and figure out a way to make it happen for yourself. And so when others hear this, I'd like to be for them to be able to understand what they might be able to do, even if it's not trying to be a SEAL. You know, you want to try to reach a goal. What can you do to, you know, even when you just want to, I mean, you think to yourself you might want to give up. You're like, nope, not going to happen.
But when
we come back, okay? we'll have him answer that question. I've just pulled one of AB's things here, right?
They don't.
We'll talk more with Ian Hogue when we come back. This is Voices of Reason. Jason Lee, Amy Donaldson, Voices of Reason, speaking today with Ian Hogue, who's a friend of mine who is a former Navy SEAL and has done some very amazing things in his life that we're going to get to hopefully in the next 20 minutes or so. The first, though, that really jumped out at me.
Among the many amazing things
is you became a Navy SEAL. And one of the things I think that's really important is for people to understand, beside the physical things you have to go through, because a lot of people can do those things sometimes. What do you have to do to get mentally prepared to overcome whatever obstacle you have to actually achieve a goal like that you just described, for instance, becoming a SEAL?
I don't know. Like I said, it was the mindset I went into it with of just knowing that I would keep going until, you know, even if I was crawling when everyone else was running, I would keep going. And I was just, how I went into it. But honestly, I feel like I learned more when it all went wrong.
Okay.
When things didn't work out for me. I got to a SEAL team, and I feel like they made some mistakes. I definitely made some critical mistakes, and that was like my rock bottom, is when there was a loss of confidence, and I realized that I wasn't going to have a career in the SEAL teams.
What do you mean when it went wrong? Like you weren't, like you didn't get the assignment you wanted. You screwed up.
I screwed up. And my commanding officer, you know, he was really great about it. You know, he said, you know, so typically when this happens to like ship captains, right? It's called a loss of confidence when, you know, whoever's in charge of the ship captains, doesn't trust them to be in charge of that ship anymore. So it also happens to officers in charge of SEAL platoons. I was an assistant officer in charge, and they didn't have the confidence for me to lead a platoon or even a squad into combat. So, and I really don't want to go into details of all the things that went wrong.
I don't
there.
Think it matters if we're going to draw, because obviously we've not had anything like that. But everyone's been in the position where we've made a mistake, and the people that trust us most now have lost a little bit of confidence in us. And like, what do you? How do you reconcile that? What
right,
do you do?
Right. So my commanding officer told me about this thing in the Navy called engineering duty. Where so I had my engineering degree from the Naval Academy, and they would send me to graduate school to get a graduate degree in engineering, and then I could go on and what engineering duty officers do in the Navy is kind of oversee contracting and programs for the acquisition and maintenance of weapon systems, I guess.
Where does one go to get an engineering degree to do this?
So I had the choice of going to either the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, which would have been awesome. I would have loved that, right?
Monterey, California.
Right, yeah, yes. Monterey, California, or going to MIT if I could get accepted to MIT. And I grew up in Boston, so I was like, well, I could go home for 2 or 3 years. So I applied to MIT and got in. And that was – honestly, that was scarier to me than going into SEAL training.
I don't believe you.
Because like I said, like I kind of had like times of mediocre grades in high school and at the Naval Academy.
But
and,
you got in.
And I got in, right?
It's not just a matter of will. It's more, right. It's more difficult. Right.
Yeah, I knew I was going to be in an environment where I was surrounded by people who were way, you know, I wasn't even in their ballpark. Like I was
but
telling Jason,
that, but that's not true. You were in their ballpark. Well, you go to the same school they do.
No, right. but you do have that moment where you're like, am I the smartest person in the room, or the dumbest person in the room, right. or somewhere?
Yeah,
in
but
the
if you're
middle,
the dumbest
right?
person in the room at MIT, that makes you a
sure,
genius.
Sure, but you're still like in that room, right?
Yeah. So there were times when I felt like I was the dumbest person in the room for sure.
Because you told me about this one guy. Yeah.
Yeah, there was this guy. We're in nuclear fusion 201 or 101 maybe. Mm-hmm. So it's all this super high level, like differential equations. And I look over and this kid next to me in my study group, he's sitting there looking at a list of words, and he's like a national Scrabble champion or something like that. And he's memorizing all of the different words that you can make from a combination of letters. And he's the smartest guy in the class. Like he's the one getting the highest grade on every single test.
He's blowing the curve.
Curve buster. Right. Yeah.
So
curve.
That's the thing that scared me about MIT is like those classes are designed for people like him. So he's getting, you know, in the 90s on the test, I'm getting like 20s on these tests.
Yeah, but you and everybody else.
Yeah. There were other people in the class getting grades.
Right.
I ended up dropping that class, by the way. But,
but so
even though
what
I probably would have
so
passed.
Then,
but.
If you're not... If what you learn about yourself in the physical challenges is like it's just a matter of not quitting, right? Like, so yeah. you're going to have to, your body's going to have to give up before your mind does. What are you learning about the mental challenges of being at MIT about yourself? Is it the same thing? You just keep showing up and you just keep doing the work?
Yeah. So that was different because, like in that class, I learned that I do have limitations, right? And I, like I said, I ended up dropping that class. So, there are times when it does make sense to say enough is enough. I didn't need to take that class. The Navy was paying me to go to MIT to learn nuclear engineering to be able to manage projects on aircraft carrier and submarine propulsion plants, which are nuclear fission. This class that I dropped was for nuclear fusion, right? So fission is splitting of large atoms like uranium. Fusion is combining small atoms like hydrogen, which we're still trying to figure out. I think I saw last week that we set a new record of like 100 seconds or something like that of a fusion reaction that was making more energy than it took to start it or something.
Okay.
So we're still working on that. We haven't figured that out yet.
This is right? still high level stuff that you guys are working on.
Yeah. Right. So I was like, wouldn't it be cool if I studied fusion and got it and was able to like help the Navy use nuclear fusion instead of fission? But when I got into that class and I realized that I was in over my head, I was like, I don't need to do this. I'll drop this so that I can actually get the grades I need to stay in this program that the Navy requires mm-hmm. me to get.
So, I mean, again, because you mentioned that you, in this case, it seems like you learn more about yourself from kind of
bumping up against your limitations.
A challenge you came in contact with than you would if you'd have just been successful all along, right?
Right. And that was kind of an epiphany moment for me. I was like, okay, now I'm just going to focus on doing what is required of me by the Navy, which is still like way above the graduation requirements from MIT. And I'm going to enjoy this experience as much as I can. I'll still get, you know, I'm still surrounded by all these amazing, wonderful people, and I can get as much out of that experience as I can. But I can also go out and enjoy other things. So I went out and I'd been wanting to do this thing called adventure racing for years and years. I had a classmate at the Naval Academy who was training for this thing called the Eco Challenge, which I don't know if anybody has watched the TV show Survivor. Mark Burnett, before he created Survivor, he created this other TV show called Eco Challenge. And they just brought it back to Amazon last year.
I think I watched one episode of that.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So I had friends doing that. And
what
one
kind
of my
things
classmates
would they do
at the Naval Academy did that, right? And mm-hmm. I was like, if she can do that, there's no reason I can't do that.
Well, can you explain some of the things that you would have to do in the sequel channel?
So adventure racing is a team sport where you have a team, you know, traditionally is a team sport of four people, co-ed. So you have to have at least one guy and one woman. And it's an unmarked course where you have to navigate with a map and compass and find little checkpoints, sometimes hidden out in the woods or sometimes at fairly obvious locations like trail intersections. Mm-hmm. And it's multidiscipline. So biking, running, paddling, sometimes swimming, sometimes they'll throw ropes in where you're rappelling or ascending, you know, rock climbing, things like that. There have been races that have included things like rollerblading and horseback riding, so all kinds of stuff.
So what's great about this is, again, it goes back to one of the things you're really good at, which is some of the physical stuff, but it also makes you use your brain, which you've come to find out you have great qualities in that too, but you also have to use it in a way that's best serves you.
Right.
Like you say, some disciplines, not yours. Then somebody else has to do that rather than run up against that wall. You're like, okay, let's figure out a way to do this that we can all be successful doing this.
Right. Yeah.
But so did you start adventure racing while you were still in the military?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, yes, I did. So I started it while I was at MIT.
Okay.
Because you didn't have enough to do.
Well, I mean, was it a break, though, from like a different kind of challenge might be a little
sure,
bit of a break?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was recreation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So how long were you in the military?
11 years.
Okay. And what made you decide to leave?
So after MIT, I became an engineering duty officer working at the shipyards. I was assigned to Puget Sound Naval Shipyard. I was supposed to be there for 3 years. When I first got there, they detached me to Everett, Washington, which is just across Puget Sound from the main shipyard to manage repair projects on surface warfare ships, so frigates, you know, ships that I was used to serving on. And after 6 months there, my first son had just been born, and the commanding officer called me up and informed me that my number had come up to go help out the Army in Afghanistan. So I went to about a month or two of training for that, then went to Afghanistan for 6 months, came back, and, you know, I kind of in that conversation with the commanding officer before I went to Afghanistan, I said, when I come back, I want to come back to the main shipyard and work on nuclear ships. So he said, okay. So when I got back, I went to the main shipyard in Bremerton. We planned an aircraft carrier overhaul for 6 months. But the thing about this was we were going to do the overhaul down in San Diego.
Oh,
so spent 6 months planning it in Bremerton. Moved down to San Diego. There's another story there, but anyway, ended up working on two aircraft carriers for 6 months. Moved back to Bremerton. And like I said, my first son was born during this time, and we had moved, you know, so then I was 6 months away from the end of that assignment, and I was going to have to move again. So that would have been six moves in 3 years. And my wife and I were like, there's no guarantee this is going to get any better. Like, even though I'm not in this war-fighting billet anymore, there's just so much going on in the world that I might have to go overseas or wherever quite frequently. And the best we're going to do is moving every 2 to 3 years. I mean, that's just the way it is for officers anywhere in the military. You change jobs every 2 to 3 years. So we actually did a lot of praying and about what to do with the rest of my life. And that was a real eye-opening experience, too.
When we come back, we'll find out how after
how
those
that prayer
prayers,
was answered.
That's right.
Yeah.
How it was answered.
Yeah.
God, your story is great, man. When we come back, we'll have more from Ian Hogue. This is Voices of Reason. Jason Lee, Amy Donaldson back. This is our last segment, and there's so much to go to, so I'm going to try to get you going here, Ian. You realize at this point, you're toward the end of your career, you have to make a decision.
Right.
Whether you want to stick with this military thing or move on to something else. And you said you and your wife, you went and you prayed about it.
Right. So, you know, in the Navy, I feel like the Navy does a lot of good things, but during my time at MIT, I started to think about, you know, what are the big problems facing the world? And one of the big problems that I see is how are we going to keep generating energy for an exponentially increasing population and do it without polluting the world terribly, right? You know, it's just going to keep getting worse if we keep doing what we're doing. So I really wanted to get into the energy the energy sector and start to understand what those challenges were to that transformation that I felt like needed to happen or needs to happen and is happening right now. And that's one of the wonderful things that I get to see now is and be a part of this transformation that's happening.
Because right now your regular job is
right. So I work for a big utility as a senior engineer. And I gather cost and technical information for any sort of electricity generating resource that we might want to build for the next decade or two. And then I get to do some of the early project development when we do decide to build things.
And you find that fulfilling why?
So that information then feeds into a modeling group who kind of tries to figure out what's going to be the best thing for our customers, what's going to be the best combination of generation resources, and And it's really neat to see the transformation from, you know, coal and gas being the kind of the lowest cost, most reliable resource to this future of a lot of renewables, which aren't quite as renewable or quite as reliable. But then there's this energy storage piece that you can apply to make it more reliable. But still, it'll never get there. You know, if you're trying to get to 100% renewable generation, you know, it could, but it would just take this astronomical amount of energy storage to give you the same level of reliability. So it's really an exciting time where we're dealing with all these challenges. And at the same time, there's this huge human element of the people who are working at those coal mines, those coal plants, those gas plants. Just my personal like recreation thing.
Kind of an escape?
Maybe, yeah. An escape and you know, I guess it I have never really thought about it until you asked, but it, because it's a team sport, it forced me to reach out to people that I wouldn't have otherwise reached out to try to form, you know, friendships. And I have just the most amazing friendships from being involved in racing.
Right, because as an introvert, that's not your natural right. tendency, right?
Well,
right.
And one of the things a lot of people miss when they leave the military is this idea that everywhere you go, you got a team. Like, you're not even if you have an individual duty, you have a lot of people have your back.
Yeah. Yeah. That was probably the scariest thing about leaving the military is, you know, there was this one company I went and worked for like a month after I got out, and nobody had my back. the CEO of the company, I remember her saying at one point, the only reason we haven't fired this guy yet is because I haven't figured out how to.
And like, talking about you.
No. Oh, talking about someone else. But I was like, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, right.
Like, that applies to me, too. Yeah. Like, she's just trying to figure out how to fire me.
Yeah.
So after a month, they're like, you know what? We don't need you.
Yeah.
Take a hike.
Yeah.
Well, and again, they did you a favor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So was that transition hard for you?
Yeah, it was scary. It was really scary. That being my first experience in the civilian sector, that was another thing. Like, I went into the interview and I was talking about like military versus civilians, and I had no idea that this was offensive to somebody to refer to them as civilians. I was like, no, like, it's just a differentiation. I don't know.
It's
like,
to let you know.
It's just how we talk to anybody.
I don't know, but the guy interviewing me was offended that I was talking about civilians. I don't know. Maybe it was just like...
No, but I mean, that does give you some insight, because I always wondered like why veterans had a harder time getting jobs after they leave the military, which is a fact. It's an absolute fact. And I thought, it seems to me that companies would be scrambling
totally
to hire veterans, right? But right. It's nobody maybe what you're saying is like this dynamic of you thinking we're all on the same team, everyone has each other's back, versus a company where people are competing for the boss's attention or reward, you know, individual rewards might be different. I don't know. I've always just been baffled by why that is an issue in this country.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, one of the things I loved about engineering duty in the Navy was the training they gave me in project management and leadership that I hadn't had before. It was like a next level of leadership that went along with project management. And all of that was really transferable outside of the Navy. And it's what got me the next job that I had for a few years and then also my job that I have now.
So. You mentioned, too, when we were talking kind of offline at some point, that you also realize being in the Navy serves you because, and especially since you actually been to combat, so you know what it's – well, you've been in places where there have been combat, I should say.
Yeah.
So you know what a real life and death situation could look like. And when you have a challenge or when you have something that people in civilian life think this is, you know, really,
this
really
is the
tough.
End of the world.
This is the end of the world, right? You're like, not really.
Yeah.
So explain how, you know, that changes your perspective and allows you to have something that gives you an advantage. I mean, even in civilian life, in terms of being able to accomplish goals when it comes to doing your job.
Well, thing we were talking about the other day. So my first real job after I left the Navy was doing project management for a small construction company. And and my office mate was a retired Marine Corps pilot. And when things would get a little bit stressful or challenging, we'd just look at each other and be like, hey, there's no one shooting at us.
Yeah.
This isn't that bad.
Right, right.
My dad used to say no one's dead or dying, so we're okay.
So, I mean, that helps too. But let's go up to this adventure thing. You know, so you start these things. You're able to start a successful career. But, again, you find interest outside of work. And you choose something that, you know, to the average person. And Amy does this too, right? I have no idea why anybody – or how they just get through 100 miles, or now you're about to do, Amy's about to do something with this, 150 miles is some team thing.
Yeah.
And you do these adventure races that also involve, you know, great distances with, you know, physical, you know, just mind-blowingly challenging stuff. How do you get there, and how do you get so much joy out of it?
I guess I just go into it with the with some passion that I get to see just these spectacular places that most people don't get to see. And
because you mountain bike.
Yeah, I mountain bike, I trail run, I paddle. You know, most of the training for these things is pretty mundane. You know, I'm like running up and down the same mountainside day after day, you know, if I'm training for a 100-mile run. Or like I'll go paddling on the Jordan River, just the river that runs through Salt Lake City. It's an inner city river. There's trash all over the place, homeless people living on the banks.
I have seen a beaver there, though, because I fell off my paddleboard in the river.
Right. So there's still like these amazing things that you can see. Like,
see, that's the thing.
Like, my friend and I paddled 26 miles or 20 miles of it.
Yeah.
In a canoe one time, and saw 26 beavers in those 20 miles.
And for me, I always am. Like, I vacillate between this, like you say, this monotony of training and doing the same thing over and over, but also that it's never the same thing.
Right.
And that there's always something different and crazy and unexpected in that and beautiful. Like, there's plenty of times where I've been like, this is terrible. Why did I do this? I'm freezing. I can't feel my feet. I have a blister on the back of my heel, and I'm hating everything that I ate the day before. And then I see the sunrise, and I'm like, I'm so lucky. Like, this is the reward.
Yeah.
So it's just that mixture. And that's what life is, right? It's always, you never have. I was just writing this morning in my journal about how the best days never start the best. Like, you never, and I was listening to an audiobook where they said, when you have grief or something bad happen, you always remember the last best thing, right? That last moment of joy, that last really delicious breakfast or whatever it was, right? You always, so, and that's to me what, all endurance sports give you is this idea that life is just a big mashup of really crappy stuff and then these really spectacular, transcendent, beautiful moments. And you have to be smart enough and with it enough to recognize them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, most of life is just the mundane, but yeah, you get, you know, if you can recognize those beautiful moments and how you got to those beautiful moments, and just
you know, showed up.
Remember that, and keep showing up and doing what got you there. You know, you can find that passion in just about anything.
We're coming down to the close of this. I was hoping you could kind of share what would you tell people who aspire to different things, and maybe they think, you know, like you did initially, you got to your goal, but there's still more. How do you say to yourself, even though you think you may want to go someplace, either there's either other paths to get there, or there may be things that you didn't know that you could do, but you can always strive to do more.
In other words, the peak of Everest is not the goal.
Right.
It's just part of the journey.
So that's actually another thing that I loved about engineering duty. They made us build this plan for our entire career, and they told us up front, they said, you're going to build this plan and it's not going to happen. It's going to be completely different. But the fact that you have a plan and you can see where you are on that plan and see, you know, what you know is coming up, then you can make more informed decisions. And just the process of making that plan, you can think about, what do I want to do at this point in my life? You know, like, it made me realize that, hey, I'm going to have kids and I'm going to be caring for them until they're at least 18 years old and probably even beyond that. But, you know, I'm pretty much stuck, you know, helping my kids grow and develop for at least those 18 years. You know, in my house, mm-hmm. right? And then after that, I might be able to move around a little more, right? Or, you know, if I want to give them the benefit of having a stable childhood in one neighborhood, mm-hmm. You know, it's those kinds of things. So those big picture, you know, if you look at your life from like this big picture of like, you know, there's these phases in your life and this is how they're going to impact everything else in your life. So like, if I want to have a career where maybe I end up influencing policy in Washington, D.C., I don't want to live in Washington, D.C. while my kids are growing up and developing. But maybe I can do that later on in my life, mm-hmm. right?
And I always want to say, you know, not everybody gets to do these big crazy things. So if you're aspirations don't necessarily involve going to MIT or getting a graduate degree, whatever it is you're trying to do, you still have to have the same mindset that this is your plan. You can still accomplish these goals no matter, you know, how divergent they can be.
Right. Or if it doesn't go according to the plan, if you don't accomplish the goal that you put on the plan, that you can make alternate plans.
Mm-hmm. And so you can strive no
yeah.
matter what.
Yeah. Find something else that will be meaningful.
Excellent. I really appreciate you doing this for me, man.
God, oh,
this is a story.
Now we all feel like underachievers, but thanks a lot,
okay.
Ian.
But we know we can do some stuff because
there's still time. There's still time.
If
right?
you just think about what he said earlier, it's like it just never occurred to him that he couldn't do it.
No, that, you know, and I've met athletes like you before yeah. in covering sports 20
That's
years.
Fantastic.
I'm always wondering, how do people do it? And they're always wondering, why
no,
did
no,
he quit?
It did occur to
yeah.
me that it might not
yeah.
work out. Like,
yeah.
like I said, like, yeah. even if I'm like crawling while everyone else is running, like that might be the end. Like they might
yeah.
pull me and say, you're not good enough. Right.
Yeah. But that's how it was going to end.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, I didn't have that at that time. I didn't have that plan of what else would I do or what would I do next. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. So you had to develop that.
Yeah. Okay, well. Yeah. And that's where I learned the most was in having that failure and then having to and then having that job where I had mentors who said, hey, make a plan for the rest of your life, mm-hmm. basically. And then having to go through that whole thought process is what really pulled me out of the dumps, really.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, join us again for the next episode of the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. If you have any comments about our show, please contact us via email at voramed@gmail.com or at vorjasonl@gmail. You can also find us on Twitter at @adonsports and at @jasonlee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VORpodcast. Check out our Facebook page, and you can also find and subscribe to free episodes of our podcast in all the places where you find podcasts. And, you know, be sure to review our show. We love getting your feedback. It helps us grow our audience. Until next time, I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason.
Voices of Reason is a production of the Loudmouth Project.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.